Today is April the 25th, 2018. Do you know who has your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, also available on prn.fm and on our website pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio in New York and PRN.FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are, well, a little different. Facebook continues to be in the news as to how they interpret data protection and privacy. The General Data Protection Regulation, known as GDPR, is a regulation in European Union law on data protection and privacy for all individuals within the European Union. It limits websites to what data is allowed to collect in the European Union. It also requires the users to consent to data collection when visiting a site. That is to say, privacy is the default. The regulations were approved in April of 2016, with a two-year transition period. They go into effect on May the 25th, 2018, which is next month. So websites that want to operate in Europe are currently finalizing their implementation, and that includes Facebook, which holds data on many European Union citizens. No matter what changes, Facebook will have to abide by the GDPR in Europe. Failure to do so will result in fines as high as 4% of global annual revenue. For Facebook, that could be billions of dollars. Anxious to limit its exposure to that kind of financial hit, Facebook will change the terms and conditions that many users can agree to. Facebook has previewed its new privacy settings, developed to meet new European privacy legislation that comes into force next month. CEO Mark Zuckerberg has said Facebook will implement new European Union rules everywhere, which all sounds pretty terrific until you read the fine print, as the devil is always in the details. While Facebook may claim that it is offering European Union-style control globally, however, removing this provision in its own terms of service suggests that the company is trying to, well, mitigate its potential legal liability. Facebook's entire business model is built on gathering as much information as possible on you and then figuring out how to use that information to make as much money as possible. Facebook gives people the appearance of choice and then carefully directs users to make the right ones. Pick a card, any card, but you always end up with the one that they want you to have. It will take, however, whatever you give it, and if you don't specifically stop it, it will sell that information in any way it can. A good example is the fact that Facebook decided to allow advertisers to access your private messages. That's right. It introduced an API to let anyone read your personal messages. All it had to do was get you to agree, and several companies have already testified how ridiculously easy it was to get people to simply tap a button. Sometimes, Facebook rolls out a new feature like face recognition and turns it on automatically, leaving it up to you to figure out how to turn it off. Since it gives you the option of turning it off, as far as Facebook is concerned, all is fine and dandy. Facebook has gone to great lengths to get you to simply agree to share all your information. This is most apparent in the persistent appearance of friendly blue buttons, accept and continue. Continue. Save. You can, of course, go through the settings and actually prevent, at least in theory, Facebook from sharing your information. You could stop it from tracking you wherever you go. You could prevent it from automatically identifying and tagging you in pictures that anyone else take and uploads. You should be able to stop it from bugging you and listening in 24/7 to what you say in order to find some kind of match between what you say in private and any one of thousands of companies willing to pay to have their ad appear on your phone. All these things are possible, but boy, does Facebook make it a struggle. You have to go through and keep making change after change after change, and all the while, There's a shiny blue button. Just tap it and you jump to the next screen, and just tap it and trust Facebook to handle the rest. Or you could, you know, hit the gray button that says Manage Settings and walk through every damn setting that Facebook has decided that needs to exist, complete with an argument on every page as to why it's a good idea to allow Facebook to have that information. It will take whatever you give it, and if you don't specifically stop it, it will sell that information in any way it can. A good example is the fact that Facebook decided to allow advertisers to access your private messages. Why would any company imagine that giving commercial entities access to their users' private messages were acceptable? We haven't heard an answer from them yet. And to add to that, the Facebook has announced that they have 9 different levels of security that you can say, I want to opt out or opt in. And I'm saying, why 9 different levels of security checks you have to go through? Your log history, your account history, your event history, your search history. Hey, wait a minute. Why can't I have a button that says it's all or none? Hey, Joe, what do you say?
Well, I have a few things to say on that. First of all, they do have a button, or in essence a button, that says all or none, and I've pressed that button. It's called discontinue membership. I don't like their policy, but I got a different question for you, Hank. What about a person like me, for example, with a very simple website that's aimed primarily at my blood relatives? Somebody in Europe can pick that up, and I'm not adhering to any of their regulations on privacy. What's my liability?
Well, as you know, Joe, and I hate to use this cliche, you are the product.
I am indeed the product, and I opted out of being the product. But I'd like to point out a couple of things. Somebody I interviewed, and she asked to be remain nameless, but I'm allowed to use the data, said, I don't know what you guys on the radio are talking about. I'm very proud to let them know what I believe, what my political party is, how healthy I am, what I enjoy doing. I'm proud that they picked me to help them make decisions.
Well,
interesting. There's another part of that story, and that was in today's Times. They interviewed a bunch of people who are, like you and me, Hank, very privacy conscious. They very much are in favor of network privacy. But they were perfectly willing at the pizza parlor to give away 5 or 10 email addresses of their closest friends in order to get a free piece of pie. Not a whole pie, just a slice.
Joe, you know what they call that? Customer acquisition.
Is that what they call it?
Yeah.
I got another name for it, but I think there might be FCC regulations about my using it.
No, I think it's FCC, by the way, Joe.
That's what I said.
At the Senate hearing, I was a little surprised to hear, and then I understood it was that Zuckerberg was asked, how many data points do you have on average for each account you have? And that's a fancy way of saying, how much information do you have? The data point is a single piece of information. They have on average over 26,000 data points on average for each individual. That means they know what you eat, what you buy, where you shop, where you go. So this friend of yours saying, well, you know, to have them know who I'm related to, that's fine. But do you really want them to know what medicine you're taking or when did you last see a doctor and all that?
Why not?
None of their business.
No, it is their business. That's precisely their business.
I am sick and tired of getting every day at least 3-4 messages. This is your final call for a medical alert. It's not a final call. It's the same voice. Of course, each time I look at the caller ID, it's a different number. Well, what a sham that is about the do not call bit, because all they do is, oh, okay, let's find out who I do not call. You get the phone numbers, and every time they call you, they're a different company, different phone number.
But you haven't answered my question and you haven't responded to the young lady I interviewed. What's wrong with all that information being handled by people? I'll give you an example. Pfizer is a giant drug company, multinational drug company. Wouldn't they like to know that I use one of their products? I mean, what's the problem?
The problem is my medical history is my business, not your business.
Okay? Everything you do is your business, and my business is knowing about it so I can sell you things that you really want so that I can not send you...
Wait a minute now, Joe. Let me give you a good example, okay? So, I'm not looking for a job. I'm way past that. But if I was looking for a job and a prospective employer goes in to Facebook and be able to get information on what my medical history is, he's a high risk, low risk, or he used to smoke, therefore, he's subject to illnesses later. I'm not going to hire him. You think that's fair?
Of course it's fair. This is a capitalistic country. I'll give you another example of what's fair, and you might not think it's fair, but I know that it's fair. Suppose that you are a victim of identity theft, and you put on your Facebook page that you have suffered from identity theft. Well, that gives a benefit to all those identity thieves out there not to bother stealing yours. It's already been stolen.
By the way, I have to interrupt to tell you, I have the Brooklyn Bridge to sell you, okay? Hey, Joe,
point that I'm trying to make, Hank, is what you and I think of is not necessarily what everybody thinks.
I know.
I saw one fact, and I believe you were the one who sent it to me, that absolutely blew me away, that there is now a free, you don't pay for it, a free artificial intelligence program that can take a still photo of your face,
right,
and merge it into a video, and as the video turns, the body in the video turns and everything, your face moves around with it appropriately.
And it can synthesize your voice to say different words.
And as long as they have a sample of my voice, for example, they tape one or two shows and they have all the things that I've said, they can now create a speech that they want to sound like me, which I never said.
Joe, by the way, you know what they call that? Deep fake. F-A-K-E. Deep fake.
Deep fake.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't think too much about it until the article that I read continued to say that some pervert had taken a famous woman's face and put it into a very filthy pornographic movie, and there was no way to tell it was faked. Now, you told me that there are some very detailed ways to get the
fake. For the average person, you're not going to go through the forensic. In other words, a technical person, if you understand the how audio and video can come together and be edited and how you can determine how it's edited, yeah, you can determine it. But for the average user, you won't know it.
Well, in essence, what does that mean? It means that anything I see or hear or read on the web can be wrong, can be a fake, can be a copyrighted piece of garbage.
It
has now changed things a little bit. Where my grandmother used to say to me, well, it's got to be true because I read it in the Brooklyn Eagle.
No. It's got to be true because I read it in the New York Times, isn't it?
Same thing. This was years before that. It's no longer true. If you read it in the newspaper, the only thing it means is that it was printed in the newspaper. If you see it on the web, the only thing that it means is it was put on the web by somebody. You can't believe anything you read, hear, or see. What does that mean for our democracy?
Joe, I do want to go over a quick headline that came across the newswire late yesterday, and it's real news, and I think it's welcome news, and I only have a skimpy part of it.
I just want to interrupt for one quick thing. You said you saw it on the newswire?
Yeah.
They haven't had a newswire since 1943.
Okay. I mean,
by the way, by the speech you use, you can determine the person's age, okay? And I do not go back to Spartacus, all right? Windows, Microsoft Windows has a new version of Windows 10.
Hold it.
Joe, I got to move on.
You threw that thing out, and it's unbelievably important.
A Spartacus? Come on.
No, about being able to tell a person's age from listening to them.
No, I said by listening to the words they use, the speech they use.
Listen, the speech pattern.
Yeah, Joe, I just want to tell you that Microsoft has a new version of Windows 10 being released. We have sketchy details on it. All I know is that it's quite exciting from my point of view. We're going to report more on it next week. But they have a new operating system called Windows 10 Lean, L-E-A-N. And some of the features is that it uses less storage to install, like 2 gigabytes of storage less. It doesn't it eliminates a lot of the gee-whiz, the colorful things. In other words, they're getting to something that is really what you really use in an operating system. Now, like, how many people need RegEdit, okay? Most people don't even know what RegEdit is. How many people have to change their wallpaper? Well, you know what? People don't realize that when they put fancy wallpaper on, it eats into CPU. They keep it simple. So I'm looking forward to that, and I want to be able to report on it. So I just want to get that out. And
Hank, you had mentioned to me in passing that Windows 10 took up so much space on one of your very old machines.
No. Very new machine, because I only had 32 gigs on it. And with all the patches, I finally ran out of room. And I found a workaround on it. What I did was I just reinstalled the latest version. So it took out all the patches. And because, as you know, when they patch, they don't really replace. They just put another layer of coding on. And before you know it, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And so what I did was I made sure I had the serial ID for the machine. And then I just went to the Microsoft site, downloaded the matching version of Windows 10 to the machine, installed it. They asked for the serial ID. I said, here it is. And I picked up 10 gigabytes that way.
And without picking up that 10 gigabytes, your small computer would have been outdated and useless.
Right. Hey, Joe, you know, talking about being outdated and all that, I know there's something that's bothering you, and I gave you some statistics on it, and you have some mixed feelings on it. This has to do with Fios. As most people will know, Fios is, at least from what our experience is, people like to have it. It's fast. It's faster than Spectrum, but not everyone can get it. And then I looked at some of the numbers, and I said, Joe, they're installing it. In Staten Island, about 85% of the people have Fios. And you say, yeah, but I'm in Manhattan. Well, you know what? You live in sophisticated elite Manhattan, of course you're not going to get it, right?
Well, here's the thing, Hank, and you skipped over it. The Verizon people who are in charge of Fios signed a contract with New York City where they would get either a tax rebate or something, a certain amount of money for every person able to get Fios.
And they had an excellent lawyer writing that contract.
Right. The contract did not say the person had to buy Fios to be credited to the Verizon account, just had to be able to. And that's a good deal. It meant that every house, every apartment in Manhattan would have the ability to sign up for Fios, right?
Even if they want it, they may elect to say, you're not getting it yet.
Well, it turns out that they said everybody's available to get Fios if the wire passes by in that neighborhood. Not goes into your apartment, just passes by out on the street. And when I said to them, well, can I get it into my apartment? They said, we'll let you know when it's available. And that was 4 years ago.
Now, wait a minute, Joe, they didn't say that to you. What they said to you is, they said, when hell freezes over. Isn't that what they said?
No, they did not. And I want you to know that there are people who get Fios who really didn't want it and don't care about it. And there are people who want Fios and can't get it. And Some people say, well, that's the fault of the building owners, of the management. No, it's not.
Yes,
that's
it is. Now, wait a minute.
That's the fault of Verizon.
Verizon said they can't get into the building.
Sure they can get into the building. I have a telephone from, well, I don't. But I used to have a telephone from Verizon. They're in the building all the time. Down in the basement, there's an antique switch box that they still use.
Well, let me ask a simple question, okay? Take the case of Staten Island, which is mostly single-family homes. Very high percentage of Fios insulation. So obviously it's not that they don't want to install it. They're doing it. So it must be buildings. The building management, the building supers are saying, I'm on the take, give me a little money.
First of all, the building management in most cases is not on the take.
I know. I just said that to get you give you a rise.
What the building management has said is if there is any expense involved in this, it's your expense. You're the one selling the service. And I think the main reason, I have no idea. I really don't. I'm guessing. Nobody at Verizon talks to me. I ask them. They don't answer me. I think the real reason is they have figured out that right now, in many cases, if not all cases, it's not worth it to them to install it in the building. I know that a building that in which I had an office up until a short time ago, that building had been wired or cabled or whatever you want to phrase it with the kind of cabling that Verizon needs. And they were just waiting for Verizon to come in and do the apartment by apartment installation.
Joe, I'm going to give you 1 minute to respond to me on this, okay? Why is it that in Staten Island and largely in also Queens, a very high percentage of it, you have a lot of these single family homes and two family homes? They seem to be getting Fios. The buildings are not getting it. Is it because it's people are cord cutting and they're afraid of just installing and then the business goes away? I'll let you wrap up the subject for me.
Okay, we're almost out of time. I'll say very quickly, they're selling it to the individual homeowners because it's a very cheap install. And they know that when they put it in, they're also getting telephone service and they're getting everything that the fiber optic can provide. In the apartment buildings, there is no rule. In a rental apartment building, there is no rule that everybody in the building has to sign up for Fios. So they still have to wire the entire building. And my guess is they've just decided that unless they can be guaranteed 50, 80, 90, 100%, whatever it is, they're just not going to do it.
Well, Joe,
they're getting their subsidy from the city whether they do it or not.
I have a suggestion for people who want Fios and you happen to have a competitive cable service. The cable franchise expires, I think, in 2 years. That means that they're going to have to start negotiating for renewal of that franchise. I would suggest to those who want it is to contact your council person and contact City Hall and say, listen, the city negotiates the master contract for Charter, which is used to be Time Warner, RCN, and also for Verizon's Fios. Put it exact wording saying you will provide it, otherwise you don't get the franchise. So we'll just leave it at that. And next week, I will be talking more about Windows 10 Lean.
Our feature segments tonight from the Tech Corner, I'll be talking about recycling used and unwanted computer equipment. And I will also follow this with the question, is the T-Mobile Sprint proposed merger good for the consumers? And Marty Winston on the home automation front will be talking about lightning protection for the cybernetic house. Even after years of industry-leading growth, T-Mobile still has tens of millions fewer customers than its larger competitors, Verizon and AT&T. Its scale of size is its biggest disadvantage. But T-Mobile has turned that weakness into a strength. T-Mobile has aggressively attracted customers in ways that destroy margins for its competitors. T-Mobile periodically offers customers more value. Those moves include
things like unbundling smartphone devices from service plans, removing music and video streaming from data caps, switching to a single unlimited data plan, and including taxes and fees in its pricing. As T-Mobile adds more customers and sees leverage in its fixed operating expenses, it can either let the increase in profit flow to the bottom line, or, and it does, it can reinvest the excess margin in adding value to its service. Higher value plans in turn attract more customers to T-Mobile. AT&T and Verizon, meanwhile, are forced to play catch-up with the moves that T-Mobile has made. T-Mobile aggressive pricing has put pricing pressure on its larger competitors, which have seen service revenue fall considerably since T-Mobile started this strategy about 5 years ago. The pressure to offer unlimited wireless data and unbundled device payments has put pressure on margins for AT&T and Verizon. The consumer has benefited from this competition. T-Mobile family plans, for example, offer higher customer lifetime value and lower average customer acquisition costs. As such, T-Mobile regularly runs promotions where customers can add a line for free because it makes it harder to switch and lowers the average customer acquisition cost. T-Mobile also offers a special deal for couples 50 years and older. When compared to other demographics, people over 55 years of age on average are much more creditworthy. They don't switch carriers as often and don't use as much data. That makes them more profitable when signing up on a regular T-Mobile plan. But T-Mobile can attract more of those customers and keep its profit margin stable if it lowers pricing for that group. Verizon and AT&T are looking for ways to keep revenue per user from shrinking further by offering higher price plans. T-Mobile is looking for ways to cut its prices or increase the value of its plan while maintaining price and funding it through an increase in scale. That's how it's turning its biggest disadvantage into a bigger advantage. T-Mobile and Sprint has been in merger talks to create an entity to compete with Verizon and AT&T on scale of size. It was on and off with the merger of T-Mobile and Sprint. Then it was on and off again. Here we go again. Maybe the third time is a charm. Sprint and T-Mobile are back at it again. The two companies are said to be working on a way to find the common ground that lets them merge after the two failed sets of talks. The most recent failure came after SoftBank, Sprint's parent company, had concerns about relinquishing control. What do you think a merger was all about? It's not a takeover. While many say that the downsides of any merging of the two companies are less consumer choice, not much has been said about the benefits, not only to Sprint and T-Mobile, but to the consumer. No matter where you stand on the benefits and drawbacks of the two companies getting together, it's interesting to look at any changes that could happen. On the corporate level, both Sprint and T-Mobile see huge benefits from any merger, but for different reasons. The obvious is all the ways this helps the two companies compete with AT&T and Verizon, who each have more subscribers than the other two combined. With a new entity, there will be more competition for things such as spectrum auctions, because a united Sprint and T-Mobile not only has more revenue, but also pose a greater risk to AT&T and Verizon. SoftBank may benefit more from any merger or buyout than anyone else. The company purchased Sprint as a way to break into the U.S. market, but its influence hasn't created the splash many thought it would. What did happen was $30 billion of long-term debt the company has incurred by absorbing Sprint. While it's likely that any deal between Sprint and T-Mobile wouldn't erase SoftBank's obligation in full, the company would likely walk away with less debt.
You're probably used to sorting your garbage into bins, green for paper or blue for plastic and glass, but when it comes to electronics, we're still used to selling those off or tossing them into the trash can. But if you have takers such as a charitable organization that can really use the equipment, you will need to clean out the data stored on the disk drive first. You are, however, not doing any charitable organizations any favor with equipment more than two generations old. Unfortunately, our gadget addiction has real consequences for the planet. making it very necessary that we dispose of everything responsibly and properly. Sure, you can try parting with your stuff for cash, but it's a pain, and it could be tough, if not impossible, to find someone who wants a system running Windows 95 with a 20-year-old CRT. Few places have curbside pickup. In fact, some localities make it illegal to leave electronics for the garbage collectors, so you're going to have to find a reputable center to take it. There are some outlets to help you dispose of your broken and unwanted computers, televisions, and any other computer gear that is not really being used as a doorstop, it's just taking up space. There is no national electronics recycling law at this time, so you won't find any federal programs to assist you with getting rid of old devices. The post office does run a program for federal agencies and their employees, but it's not available to the general public. Instead, the rest of us have to rely on nationwide retailers to toss out our old stuff. Best Buy has over 1,000 locations in the United States, so it's likely you have one nearby you where you can drop the stuff off. You just need to take it to the customer service counter. They'll issue you a receipt, but keep in mind that you can't claim the drop-off as a deduction on your taxes since Best Buy isn't a charity. You can even recycle televisions and monitors, though you'll be charged a fee of $25 per item to cover the higher cost of transporting and disassembling them. Best Buy limits you to 3 items per household per day, including up to 2 televisions. There are only 300 Staples stores nationwide, but it has some perks over Best Buy. You can bring up to 7 items per day, and if you recycle a printer, you can get $50 off a new one. Recycling your stuff follows the same process. Just bring your products to the customer service center for receipt. Staple Rewards members also receive a small credit of $2 for every used ink cartridge they turn in, and up to 20 a month. Unfortunately, Staples does not recycle televisions. Office Depot has over 1,300 locations to choose from, but unlike Staples and Best Buy, it won't recycle your old gadgets for free. If you're only getting rid of a few phones or batteries, well, those can still be turned in at no charge. But for everything else, you must purchase a tech recycle box, which costs $5, $10, or $15, depending on the size. You can fill it with as many items as you want, provided they all fit inside, and this includes smaller televisions. So it's a great deal if you have a lot of stuff that you want to dispose of, and if you're looking to turn in some ink cartridges, Office Depot also offers $2 per cartridge, but only if you make a purchase of $10 or more in the same month. If you can't make it to a retail location, especially when you only need to get rid of one or two items, many companies offer recycling programs for their own products. They'll even pay for shipping. Some run their own programs while others use outside organizations. While Amazon would love to direct you to a trade-in program, you're probably reading this post because there's stuff you can't sell, and for those items, Amazon offers mail-in recycling. You can send in your busted Kindles, your Fire TVs, and even dash buttons, as well as select peripherals like keyboards and mouse pointers. You'll just need to fill out some forms online and generate a shipping label, which you can slap on any box. Drop it off at a UPS location, and you're good to go. Amazon will cover all the cost. If your iPhone or MacBook is still in good shape, you should consider selling it, but if it's old or beat up, you can still score a gift card by turning it into Apple's recycling program. For iPhones, iPad, and Apple Watches, you'll be asked to fill out a form attesting to the product's condition and given a trade-in quote. With a working iPhone 5 going for $35, an iPhone 7 Plus will get you $315, and for Macs, you'll be asked to provide a serial number as well. Though Apple won't give you any cash for anything deemed old or unacceptable, you can still mail it in and bring it to any Apple store so it can be responsibly disposed of. Dell offers drop-off recycling via a partnership with Goodwill. Not every location participates, but there are over 2,000 of them. And because it's a charity, you may even be able to deduct it as a donation off your taxes. Dell also has a mail-back program on its site where you can generate a shipping label and drop-off package off at a FedEx location. You can ship old products back to Epson by simply creating a shipping label on its site and dropping it off at a FedEx location. If you can, HP recommends taking its product to the nearest Best Buy or Staple. But if that's not feasible, the company participates in a program that will even buy back some items. You'll be asked to fill out a form with the make, model, and condition, and the recycler will email you a prepaid shipping label to mail the package within 30 days. If you're doing a buyback, you'll receive a paper check in the mail. Because this isn't an in-house program with HP, you can also send in items from other companies. Many other companies use outside recyclers to dispose of their products, and you'll often see the same names popping up again and again across different manufacturers. This should simplify things in some cases. You should be able to send in products from multiple sources in one package. You just need to fill in the make and the model to generate a prepaid shipping label. However, different states have different rules on what you can return, so that the drop-down for selecting your product may vary by jurisdiction. Two major recycling companies you'll notice a lot are RLGA, which covers Acer, Canon, Google, Intel, Lenovo, Microsoft, and Motorola products, and MRM, which recycles products for Alcatel, BlackBerry, Barnes & Noble, TCL, and Toshiba. Cell phones are the easiest gadgets to recycle. If you haven't already decided to sell yours off on eBay, Declutter, Gazelle, and Echo ATM, but if you can't or won't make some cold hard cash off of it, you can send it to Call to Recycle. That's C-A-L-L, numeric 2, R-E-C-Y-C-L-E, which has drop-off centers all over the country in many chain stores, including Lowe's and Home Depot. They also accept rechargeable batteries as well. Cell phones for soldiers can be made, which accepts phones in any condition and sell them to refurbishers or recyclers. The proceeds go toward purchasing phone cards for troops so they can call their friends and families back home. To be clear, the phones are not given directly to the soldiers. All four of the major carriers, including Verizon and T-Mobile, offer free recycling as well. You can trade in your old device in the store or send it in for a credit towards a new phone or let them straight up recycle it. AT&T participates in cell phones for soldiers while Sprint runs the 1 million project, which works to get disadvantaged kids' devices and internet access. If you do decide to try your luck with Gazelle or Echo ATM to see if your old phone is still worth a few bucks, and it turns out it's worth nothing, you can at least rest easy knowing that both companies will recycle your phone responsibly. There may not be a national law dictating that you must recycle your electronics, but at least 26 states have passed their own laws that vary widely in what they demand of both manufacturers and consumers. Almost all states that do collect products for recycling provide the service for free, with a bill footed by the companies in some way. Most provide some local programs to help you rid of your stuff, regardless of whether recycling your gadgets is required or optional. States where you can no longer dispose of electronics in the regular trash and must recycle them include California, Connecticut, Illinois, Indiana, Maine, Minnesota, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Vermont, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and the District of Columbia. The following states have been requiring manufacturers to pay for recycling, but you, the consumer, are not actually required to recycle your electronics, and they are Hawaii, Maryland, Michigan, Missouri, Oklahoma, Texas, Virginia, and the state of Washington. The following states have some special circumstances worth noting. California consumers pay a small fee of $5 to $7 when they buy televisions and laptops. This is used to reimburse recyclers for the high cost of recycling these items, so you don't get it back when you turn in these items for collection. Connecticut does not allow recycling centers to charge you a fee for turning in electronics, so many organizations that would usually charge for recycling televisions and monitors do not accept them. Since you cannot dispose of them curbside, you can take them to a municipal transfer station for free. In Michigan, in addition to hosting numerous drop-off sites, Michigan will pay for you to recycle your old gadgets by mail. Pennsylvania does not allow retailers to charge you a fee to recycle, so places like Best Buy and Staples will not accept televisions or monitors. Many recycling centers have also closed as a result of underfunding. Some nonprofit recyclers may still accept the items, and you should check to see if your local government is hosting any drop-off events. Lancaster and Dauphin counties still run civic recycling programs. With it becoming more difficult to rid of an old TV in Pennsylvania, with some people even resorting to illegal dumping, so if you have something to recycle, check the laws, go on the website and find out what you can and can't do, cannot do, as it varies from site to site. And this will be followed up in a future broadcast. If you want to give away the equipment, we'll go through how you can clean the information off your hard drive before you do it. You don't have to have a cybernetic house to be afraid of lightning, but the nature of lightning and lightning protection isn't quite what people think. And Marty ranges pretty widely in explaining it all, even to lava lamps and jellyfish in a mosh pit, before sharing a prescription for optimizing your protection.
Okay, I know we've already covered this, but it's been a while and Hank didn't remember it, and you know, it is April showers time, so at his request, I'm revisiting the measures we put into our 40-year house design to help protect it against lightning. It's a lot more complex than I first realized when I started looking into it. I'll try to present a condensed version of what I learned and then get into how the house design morphed to deal with it. Our best starting point to help spark a better understanding of lightning is a closer look at what's happening when you shuffle across the rug in winter and get that spark from your fingertip to something metal. Now, we're going to skip the part where we talk about what's positively or negatively charged. The only important thing is that their charge levels are different and not necessarily opposite. The bigger the difference, the longer the spark. That's the piece at the middle of all this. The bigger the difference in charge levels, the more likely a static discharge becomes, and the more likely it can span a longer distance. The bigger the difference. The next part is harder to visualize because it has to do with something that's invisible, at least to humans. It has to do with globs of air, with an emphasis on outdoor air. Globs. Clouds are kind of globs in that they're three-dimensional and have non-geometric shapes, but you can see clouds. And we're not yet ready to get into the role they may play. Maybe it's more helpful to think of the glob of wax in a lava lamp. It's not exactly shapeless, but other than saying glob, its shape is hard to describe, and it's always changing. So if outdoor air came in colors that could indicate, you know, the colors indicate the static electricity charge level, you would see a constant intermingling of globs. You know, some of them as small as a bucket, some of them as big as a Navy cruiser. The interaction might look like, maybe like a crowded mosh pit of jellyfish. These amorphous globs also change each other as they touch in passing. Because remember, each one is a particular charge level. It's always happening, good weather or bad, wet or dry. And what happens if two globs with very different charge levels get close to each other. There will be a discharge, a balancing of charges, which may or may not produce a visible spark called a ground flash. The biggest energy generator where lightning is concerned comes from the motion of water droplets or ice crystals in storm clouds. They build ever greater charge levels. At some point, that creates a charge difference between the cloud and what? Another cloud? A flagpole? A radio tower on a tall building? Your house? Yeah, all of the above and then some. So the question arises, can we make the house a less tempting target? The answer is yeah, but not without doing more than usual to protect it. That's an exercise that starts with adjusting an old half-truth about lightning, the idea that it will always be attracted to anything that's grounded, and the companion to that idea that the primary job of a lightning rod is to conduct lightning strikes into the ground. Getting past those is why I started talking about blobs of air. What lightning truly targets is best expressed in a phrase that you've heard before. You'll have to learn to rethink in terms of lightning. The path of least resistance. I think enough of you guys work around enough electronics to understand that resistance has a very literal meaning here, and that every path to ground or any other discharge level has an implicit resistance value. That's a good start. But also remember that the resistance of any conductor may present itself as a higher value when presented with a much higher current. So let's de-geek that a smidge. Given any two targets with the same apparent difference in charge level and at the same separation distance, the larger target is more attractive because it has the ability to handle more current. Not that lightning owns an ohmmeter or a calculator. It's also important to remember that lightning is not monogamous. It's quite within its nature to discharge to multiple targets at once. So now that we have a slightly better understanding of Sparky the lightning bolt, let's think about the idea of a lightning rod simply being there to conduct the lightning to ground. It can't. The lightning bolt would vaporize the lightning rod, its ground wire, or both. In broadcast antenna towers that get hit by lightning all the time, their really large diameter conductors, plural, fan out from the base of the tower in several directions for as much as a mile. And when lightning hits, they can turn red hot. Lightning rods, by the way, the trade name for them is air terminals. Lightning rods can and do help some smaller events get bypassed to ground, but that's only one of its roles, and the one it will play least often. Remember when I said that blobs of air that touch each other will tend to impact each other's charge levels? Well, blobs of air near a house that make contact with a well-grounded lightning rod will tend to have their charge levels reduced to something closer to ground. I think of the tip of the lightning rod, or air terminal, as a pinprick into a balloon of charge that will deflate the charge level. But it's a more contagious effect than that, since a reduced charge on one blob will, to a lesser extent, reduce the charge on the next one it touches, though we don't count on it being in contact with the ground rod very long. I interviewed a professional in the lightning protection business, and he offered these guidelines. First, when it comes to air terminals, one is never enough, and there's no number that's too many. At a minimum, one on every corner of the roof, one on each end of every roofline peak, ridge, one on each end of every roofline trough, and four around the chimney. Each one, each and every one, should ideally go to its own ground rod, with each ground rod at least 8 to 12 feet long and pounded in with no exposed top. In addition to the wire from the lightning rod, a second wire should connect each ground rod to the others, reinforcing a very low impedance path to ground that's at the same electrical level everywhere. That's important because soil, even wet soil, is an imperfect conductor, and you don't want lightning crawling back up the house through a level-separated ground wire. This ground's a little higher than that ground. There's more that can be done, but, you know, getting just this far puts you really far ahead of anybody else in terms of both being a less attractive target and in terms of being a less vulnerable target. We're not quite done. Lightning doesn't have to hit your house to fry your gear. If lines coming into your house feed lightning-induced power surges through your walls, phone lines, cable lines, even power lines can do that. Make sure they're lightning-arrested and or surge-protected outside the wall. Make sure indoor modems are plugged into surge protectors and get an electrician to add whole house surge protection at the breaker box. If you have outdoor surveillance cameras connected over wired Ethernet, whether or not it's PoE, power over Ethernet, you can add Ethernet surge protectors. And don't forget that lightning storms are a major reason for power outages. So, like Hank always says, backup, backup, backup.
Thank you, Marty, and don't let that lightning strike you where you least expect it. Public service announcements of scheduled computer club meetings in the tri-state northeastern region. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on VPN, the importance of having one, Thursday, April the 26th. The meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they'll meet at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have their meeting on Tuesday, May 1st. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Westchester PC Users Group will have their general meeting May 3rd, Thursday. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and it will be held at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor at White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their main meeting on May 4th, Friday. Meeting time is 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club has its general meeting on Thursday, May 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. The meeting will be at NYU, Silver Building, room 405, located in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will have its meeting on Friday, May 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. S. Schur Hall. By the way, if you never attended a computer meeting, you should attend. If you have any questions, this is a place you can go to where you can ask people about their experience and if they have any comments about products or problems that you may have. And all these meetings, they have a random access session that you will probably be able to ask your question, and there is no such thing as a dumb or stupid question in computing. All these computer club meetings are free and open to the public. We hope to see you at the meetings. Do you know who has your personal data?
Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio or www.wbai.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key. On behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.